You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are coming to the end. We're still in the middle of Lent, but we're coming to the end of March. This is Sunday, March, very early, Sunday, March 30th of 2025. I was on two radio shows that I like to recommend. One, absolutely, an old friend of mine, Dark Enlightenment. If you haven't come across him yet, please go. This guy apparently has been following me since the Voice of Reason days, and knows my material inside and out, as well as the material that I'm inspired by and the citations I take from. In his own right, he puts out an absolutely high quality show, and I trust him, and I trust his intellectual integrity. The other one, Jose Nino, a friend of Peter Quijones, as I like to call him. I was on Friday, two shows on that day, and talking about a lot of the same things. The Jewish question in Poland, Jewish question in the Russian Empire, because quite frankly, nothing has changed. The only change is the cultural or economic, political parameters that this state within a state has to work within. For today, we're going to talk about the process that led to the fall of the Soviet Union. This is something that when I first started college, I decided I was going to do this for a living. This was happening. And this is part of the reason why I wanted to do it. Because there was nothing like this in history. An empire collapses in peacetime on itself, and they're still debating the reasons for it. It wasn't obvious. It wasn't a slow decline like Rome, although there were elements of that here. No one had this predicted. But at the very least, we're going to go through a few of the prerequisites for the collapse, the limping towards perestroika. We can only do so much here, but it's almost as if the Soviet Union didn't survive the death of Stalin. Despite the fact that the U.S. rebuilt with credits and investment and educated personnel, the U.S. rebuilt the Soviet Union. It never quite recovered. After the war, a few years after the war, about three quarters of the pre-war land was being cultivated, with a harvest yield lower than before. There was a shortage of feed. Livestock population fell below the pre-revolutionary level. And in many areas of production, the Soviet Union never, ever, ever came even close to the pre-revolutionary levels of the standard of living, of personal income, etc. And because of the crop failure, all grain and food reserves were confiscated from the collective farms. So this was a death sentence. Even worse than 1931 and 1933, the very same Kaganovich sent to Ukraine, and this famine, which doesn't get a lot of attention because it occurred at the same time as a lot of Western aid, of 1947, 1948, you had about 1 million people die, probably unnecessarily. Most of your collective farmers didn't have passports, which meant they had no right to any free movement. They worked for free. They were attached to their collective farms. And they had to fulfill the plan by any means they possibly could. And only then could they feed their families. Remember, there was nothing in the mentality of this early Jewish Bolshevik movement that gave a damn about, certainly about the peasants, but not about the workers either, except to be manipulated However, in the Baltics, for example, you had tremendous growth after the war. Now, the Americans said that it never recognized a Soviet occupation of the Baltics. I mean, it did de facto. But you always had a nationalist partisans active there. You had a few Soviets killed. But the Soviets, because it was very close to NATO countries, forced the Soviet government to strengthen its northern military apparatus. And it permitted a certain higher standard of living to weld them to the Soviet system. There was never a time where the Gulag camps were dismantled until Gorbachev. Unpaid slave labor was a huge part of the Soviet economy. It couldn't go away without a huge collapse, or at least a tremendous downturn in Soviet production. World War II gave about 10 million new reasons to imprison people, collaborators, whatever you want to call them. Don't forget, the camp system wasn't just a prison system. It was integrated into the economy. It was in every sector, including intellectual sectors. If you read Solzhenitsyn's The Red Wheel, you'll see this. I mean, you had scientists working in the Gulag camp, in laboratories and everything else. This was a completely different... You had these projects with hundreds of thousands of prisoners working over hundreds of miles. Solzhenitsyn gives... I mean, there were others, of course, that gave us the, you know, the 4 a.m. Wake up, 10 p.m., lights out, and food at the level of survival, if it was edible at all. For those who followed people like Vlasov, that kind of political prisoner, they had special camps, and that was simply a death sentence. But when Stalin died in 1953, there was a somewhat of an explosion in the sense that maybe things will change here. But the lesson of the collapse of the USSR, you know, many years later, was that it's great that the Soviet Union collapsed. It was awful about what replaced it. Solzhenitsyn made a big deal about this in his From Under the Rubble, which no one reads. Very good. I have a hard copy of the of these essays. And Solzhenitsyn is very clear. I think it's in the preface, actually, or actually in Under the Rubble itself, says, maintain Soviet discipline, at least for a while. Because if you simply let everything go, you're going to have oligarchy, you're going to have pure anarchy in the worst possible sense of that term. But anyway, after the death of Stalin, you had revolts in the camps, a laundry list of revolts. 54 and 55, some so large that you had battles that took place over weeks with internal troops. Yerevda, Karabash, Taishent, Rishoti, there's so many of these camps. Many of them who fought the hardest were political prisoners. The death of Stalin. There were a lot of families out there. I mean, everyone had lost probably numerous people, whether it be the war, the starvation, you know, murders, whatever it might be, to the camps. So families had multiple people. So it was just pure trauma everywhere you go. You can't expect normal behavior here. But they wanted to see a review of these cases. You had bags of letters, relatives coming in. But as it turns out, from 53 to 55, maybe 15,000 were released. You had the unrest in Czechoslovakia, June 1953. And there was another one later on, of course, in 68. 53, too, East Germany, 100,000 people. And I love, you know, I'm always citing Mikhail Nazarov in his The Leader of the Third Rome. It has been one of the most inspirational books of my life. I'm getting some of this stuff from him, as well as from Solzhenitsyn. The Soviet leadership realized something had to be done. It wasn't just a cult of personality. It was one man that held it together, or at least the image of one man that held it together. And without him, even the old repressive measures aren't going to be taken seriously. There was something qualitative that changed. Nazanov and Solzhenitsyn, many others, say that the death of Stalin was the first act, the first brick to be taken out, leading to the dismantling of the system. The disappearance of this infallible leader, who through violence and terror created a single party, single regime, with his death, there was an enormous psychological change. Most of us don't have any experience with that because we've never had a Stalin. You know what totalitarianism is? It's a state apparatus, a public apparatus, that claims the right and actually does regulate every, hence total, aspect of human life. Family life, travel, economics, entertainment, religion, everything comes under the power of the state. That's the definition of totalitarianism. The collective leadership that took over also led to something awful, both from the Soviet point of view and from the natural law point of view. Individualism. Functioning when you're in fear of Stalin, and then functioning when you're actually responsible for things and could actually make a difference, that just creates ego and then rivalries. The state slowly began to weaken, and it never recovered, for better or for worse, the power and unity it had under Stalin. This is some of the reason why you still have, I think, millions of Russians who say that Stalin was a good guy. We've talked about this on this show probably a million times. It's going to come up many more times. It was a psychological change. No one is going to be able to replace someone like him. Khrushchev was about the last person you would want to put in here. I could see the reality of what he did. He first tried to discredit his rivals, and he did so. So people like Kaganovich, Brashilov, Molotov, discrediting these people and threats to him by pointing out their involvement and what everyone now knew were crimes, mass murders. Didn't make a dent in the Western world. But it was a dangerous path because Khrushchev was one of these people. 1955, Malenkov was ousted. He wasn't the chair of the Council of Ministers anymore. He brought in Bulganin, one of Khrushchev's yes men. And then he ordered an investigation under Pospilov to investigate the nature of Stalin's crimes, although it was very incomplete and deliberately so. And it all came to a head in the 20th Party Congress. February 1956, Khrushchev pretended like everything was okay. He asked the Politburo for permission to announce the results of this investigation. Molotov, Kaganovich, they tried to stop it, but Khrushchev was in a stronger position. He said, well, don't worry, I'm not going to touch on any of the biographies of the leadership here. It's going to be a closed session anyway. But then he stunned everybody. Now, he only dealt with a couple of areas of Stalin's crimes. The party members who were illegally repressed, according to him. And he touched on the illegal deportation of certain people, like Chechens and people even more obscure. Tens of millions of Russians were not mentioned at all. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether he did a piece of it or the whole thing. What was shocking was that Stalin was now held up to ridicule. And not just that, was an absolute criminal in every way. After that Congress, you did have substantial releases from the Gulag camps. You had rehabilitation commissions. You did have maybe a million people, which is still a fraction. But rehabilitation didn't concern those who threatened the regime in some way. And certainly not before 1937. The real damage that Khrushchev did, besides the Stalin thing, was he created the paradigm that's still dominant in the Western world, Western scholarship, that the Soviet Union was fine until Stalin came around. He changed everything. He destroyed everything. We would have been living in paradise had Stalin not taken over. Talk about, anti-Soviet thinking, it all seems to land on Stalin. The truth is, of course, Lenin, Trotsky were just as vicious in every way as Stalin was. They had a far more crude bureaucracy to work with. Less technology, fewer people, less security. I'm not sure Khrushchev fully understood that he was doing this. But a lot of communists said, well, no, it's not Stalin. I'm sorry, it's not the USSR, it's not Marxism, it's not Leninism, it's Stalin. He was the problem. And that's an excuse you're going to hear. You want to talk about, oh, the only bad thing about the Soviet Union was Stalin's purges. And just the purges, you need to stop them very quickly. He didn't differ ideologically, at least on anything fundamental, or in terms of tactics, with those who came before him. In other countries, the 20th Congress caused a lot of problems too, especially other socialist countries. This is where the Hungarian Czechoslovak stuff initially came from. In Hungary, of course, Soviet soldiers went over to the side of the rebels. Same thing for Poland. It's funny, the Brief Jewish Encyclopedia says this about those events, and I'm quoting here directly from the Russian. In the countries of Eastern Europe, the number of people of Jewish origin in the leadership of communist parties and governments was quite significant, which led to an increase in anti-Semitic sentiments among the broad masses of the population. In Budapest, for example, rebels hanged several of the most hated Jewish KGB officers on lampposts. That wasn't legitimate justice or legitimate revenge. It was anti-Semitic. Not just a thought, it was a feeling, it was just a sentiment. So even there, they can't handle dealing with any consequences. So the 20th Congress, suppression of the revolt in Hungary, that was a massive blow to the communist movement worldwide, especially in the Western world. Anti-communists turned out to have been right. Khrushchev confirmed what a lot of anti-communists at the time were saying about the Stalinist era. The Western communist parties, of course, were special pleading and lying through their teeth trying to justify it, but it couldn't be done. Now Khrushchev is coming out and saying it's true. Communist parties started to look bad, as they should, look like liars because they were, and members began to filter out. You had new forms, Euro-communism it was called, various forms of, Frankfurt School, all kinds of different offshoots of Marxism that came from precisely this breakdown. Still, Stalin or no, already in the late 50s, early 60s, economic reform was absolutely essential. You can't live on American lend-lease forever. Khrushchev attempted to build capital investments for consumer goods, which was always a big issue amongst Soviet citizens. Taxes on household plots, private plots, were cut in half. All kinds of sort of semi-private sector pig breeding and stuff, cow keeping were encouraged. The purchase price for farmers' grain was increased. But, they were nice band-aids, but they were just band-aids. The system was rotten entirely. As Solzhenitsyn said, the system can't function without terror. There is no reason to cooperate with that system unless there's a gun to your head. In 1956, the labor legislation that was passed by Stalin was abolished. You could change jobs now. There was an increase in housing stock, although very poor quality. They even, in 1964, had pensions for collective farmers, probably the lowest on the totem pole of the Soviet Union, absolutely loathed. Nothing was really done about it unless there was an attempt to curry favor. So neither proletarians nor peasants were even remotely in the minds of especially the first generation of Jewish revolutionaries. Khrushchev wasn't well educated, and he had a very impulsive character. He had also an immature streak, and he would say things off the cuff he shouldn't have. In 1957, it was catch up and surpass America in the production of meat, milk, and butter. All excited, but that was an impossibility. He should have said catch up and surpass pre-revolutionary Russia in those productions. He couldn't do that either. And the same thing goes for the new Communist Party program in 1961. It wasn't realistic. He promised to take first place on the planet in production of everything. Light industry and heavy industry. The current generation of Soviet people will live under communism, in the you know, the final stage sense. And it was everywhere. Khrushchev was about the last person, as I said, that should ever have taken Stalin's place. These slogans get weirder and weirder as time goes on. Machine operators to the village. That was Khrushchev's big cry. It's not meaningful to normal people. But since he had liquidated the machine tractor stations, which, although very poorly run, you know, were allowed collective farmers to have a source of machine and tractors, among other things, the transfer of equipment to collective farms led to its total destruction. Not to mention, specialists left the villages entirely. The initial command rationale was gone, such as it was. You had contradictory measures all over the place. You want to encourage livestock, but then he also discouraged it by adding new restrictions, reducing its number by half in a year and a half. Collective farms changed into state farms. In other words, they became hired agricultural workers, but it didn't change anything. He changed the rules of managing the state economy largely by trial and error, but without changing the principles, and without changing the tactics, despite his rhetoric. Not to mention the fact that he was worried about his own personal power. He needed to break the structures of the old central apparatus, and it always opposed Khrushchev, especially in his immature and impulsive modes. Decentralization of management in 1957. Republican ministries of various types were liquidated. He created the Councils of National Economy, 105 of them created in their place, for the transfer of management powers to the regional level. That also meant a division in the Communist Party between agrarian and industrial parts, formally in 1962. You had parallel structures now. That's not talked about very much, but there were a lot of people who saw sort of a two-party system here developing. A lot of confusion, a lot of discontent. Personnel rotation, big problem. Tito did something similar. He said that at each election, each party congress, he's going to change a third at all levels, from the locality all the way up to the presidium of the Central Committee. And he caused discontent everywhere. Endless reform of the educational system without any clear purpose. Intrusive assessments about in the field of culture in the army. Reduction of the armed forces and good equipment destroyed by a third. Worker settlements with the deprivation of benefits for private plots, even though he tried to encourage them not too long before. The KGB, too. The abolition of salary supplement for ranks as you went up the ladder. Even the party itself. Rotation, and the attempt to abolish privileges. There were attempts to remove him as early as 1957, the same bunch of people. Molotov, Malenkov, Kaganovich. Khrushchev was in a fairly solid position, though. The commander of the Soviet forces in World War II, who, regardless of anything else, probably had more authority at the time than anybody, Marshal Zhukov. They were brought to Moscow. They wanted an opening of the plenum of the Central Committee, but it still brought victory to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev did something very stupid. Well, I don't know. Either very stupid or very smart. It's got to be one extreme or the other. Sending Zhukov into exile, which is very unpopular. He created the anti-party opposition, or he called it the anti-party opposition. They were removed. Again, as if there's not enough confusion, they were all removed from all posts. But, you know, there is some progress, because they weren't murdered. You know, they were nomenklatura benefits and everything else. They had their pensions and stuff. Normally, they would have just been murdered, but these guys were just fired. So there is some progress here. So you get to the 22nd Congress in 1961. You know, this is going to be a two-part thing. I'm not going to be able to avoid that. The 22nd Congress, 1961, the issue was, again, Stalin's crimes. Aimed directly at the men who were there. Molotov, Kaganovich, Malenkov, Rosilov. he published their signatures for all these, you know, thousands of death sentences for enemies of the people in the newspapers. He removed Stalin's body out of the mausoleum, all this stuff. Finally, in 1964, October, the rebellion against him succeeded. Khrushchev's in the Black Sea. There was a secret meeting in Moscow with the support of the army and the KGB. They summoned Khrushchev back. I'm pretty sure he knew what was happening. It was Suslov, secretary of the Central Committee, presented a list of accusations, and he was allowed to retire for health reasons, of course. But that also, like the death of Stalin, both terrifying people and gave hope to people. The so-called Khrushchev thaw ended. You know, the thaw for the Soviet Union at the time is like the most evil tyranny today, you know, for us, for normal people. But still, it was a thaw. Anti-Stalin literature was removed. Gulag literature, the poetry from the camps, all that gone. No more releases from the camps. And who took over, as you all know, his former protege, Brezhnev. I believe I think it was the second or third lecture I ever did for Voice of Reason, for some reason, was on Leonid Brezhnev. And I did it because he gets mentioned a lot, but is rarely talked about in any depth. He returned to some form of collective leadership, which was nothing, you know, no way to replace Stalin. But Brezhnev didn't have to fight the personality cult anymore. Stalin was slowly rehabilitated, slowly. But, of course, there's a Kosygin plan. We don't have time for this. I talked about that many times. The concept of reform in 1966, you want to try to dismantle central planning without introducing market elements. You don't have anything. Economic growth, even by official figures, was collapsing. Grand total from 1966 to 70 was 7.8%. 1976 to 80, 4.3%. That's total official statistics. Even worse, though, labor productivity was falling. And of course, when all this stuff kinds happens, there are no vacuums. You have an illegal shadow economy emerging. Something has to give. Something has to fill that. And there are plenty of writers, Katasonov, Solzhenitsyn, Nazarov, me, that without this illegal shadow economy, the Soviet system would have collapsed long ago, long before 1991. In 1977, the state had to admit terribly that private plots, you know, permitted sort of, they made up 1% of the cultivated land in the country. They provided the Soviet Union with 2/3 of its potatoes, 1/3 of its vegetables, 1/3 of its milk and meat, and the rest of it. So then in 1971, the year I was born, it's no accident, Brezhnev's system declares that the USSR, bizarrely, is now a developed socialist society. In other words, the highest stage in the establishment of the first phase of communism, in mostly Engels' point of view. New constitution, Article 6, emphasizing the party character of the system. But there was something else going on. The nomenklatura, that is to say, the middle and lower part of the bureaucracy, which was a huge portion of the urban population, they were looking very closely at the Western world. And it began to resemble a state-run bourgeois mentality. They competed with one another. They envied the Western standard of living, which they're able to see. These guys started engaging in things like business trips, tourist trips for family members, trips to the West, closed medical clinics, summer cottages, holiday homes, distribution stores with all kinds of imported consumer goods that no one else can get. It was in roughly 1970-75 when that began. That also means that the nomenklatura class was now increasingly isolated from the population. It was a new class. It was a state version of an oligarchy. an actual oligarchy. The oligarchy creates the state and dominates it. In this case, it's within it. And they start, they know each other. They protect each other. And as they climb the ranks, they select people with all of the moral qualities that's required. But even for obvious crimes, you know, embezzlement, bribery, they were just transferred to another job. Outside of Russia itself and Belarus and Ukraine, Central Asian republics, for example, leadership positions were bought for a cash payment. It was almost a negative natural selection here. And let me quote the great archimandrite Konstantin Zaitsev, who talks about the time under Khrushchev. He says this. At that time, Russia was ruled by real communists. He's talking about Stalin. And what about today under Khrushchev? It's safe to say that there are no such communists in Russia now. They live in the past. They've already done their job. A certain common language is being formed between the modern communists, quote, ruling Russia and the free world, freely moving towards the Antichrist. And in this atmosphere, a certain new regime is being formed in the USSR, in which, alongside the official communist doctrine that formally prevails, the right of citizenship is granted to all kinds of self-indulgence, not only tolerated, but encouraged by the leadership. Self-indulgence that is especially tempting in the Soviet Union because it's novel, it's new, and they're therefore capable of buying people at a low price that the free world could barely understand it. This is the climate that promises to unite the entire world, both the free and the communist world. So, like the new economic policy and other things like that, the thaw of Khrushchev with another very politically forced, inconsistent retreat from the communist utopia under the pressure of reality. It really came down to the lowering the threshold of tolerable repression and recognizing a small portion of past crimes of the state against the population. But even that was enough, though. Even, you know, a small bit comes out, the imagination runs wild, and their imagination probably didn't even come close to the reality. The struggle for Stalin's succession, you had a dismantling of the regime to the left, towards atheistic internationalism and its bourgeois variety. You truly have a convergence here. But all the liberals worldwide wanted to see the worst forms of capitalism, the worst forms of Marxism, which is what rules the world today. So it's not just dismantling Marxist ideology. The thaw didn't provide anything positive. Pretending to return to Leninist norms, but Khrushchev rejected any request to preserve monuments to Russian antiquity, you know, churches especially. He passed over the 250th anniversary of the Battle of Poltava, 150th anniversary of the Battle of Borodino in 1962. Of course, this is no accident. So right away, Stalin dies, and anyone who can see the things objectively is starting to see, okay, I don't know if the Soviet Union is going to survive this. It may take a while. But any irrational, unsustainable system, if it benefits enough people, will be able to hang on. Like postmodern capitalism. Using debt to finance debt, and using that to finance debt. And the interest payment gets tacked on. And that gets financed, you know, without much value underneath, or no value underneath. No product. It's just derivatives. The financial derivatives. It's not really based on anything. It's pure postmodernism. But it will hang on for a while, as irrational and stupid though it is. But 60s and 70s, the Soviet Union also expanded into the Third World. My freshman year in college, I worried about this quite a bit. El Salvador, for example. Marxism, Leninism, socialism was really motivated by the belief that communism will have to triumph given the nature of industrial society. And so the Soviet Union was tasked to speed up the process. The Soviets targeted the poor countries in the Third World with very weak political institutions. They were the ones who were susceptible to propaganda. And they received substantial technical assistance, material assistance. Soviets planted fraternal, brotherly communist parties in the Third World, believing that this will create a coalition against the West. It'll deprive the West of certain raw materials. But the expense ended up being one of the big items that harmed the Soviet Union and brought it down. The more fraternal, the more brotherly the government was, the greater the burden on the Soviet population. So let's say by 1959, between 55 and 59, military supplies to those third world nations, fraternal nations, was under $1 billion worth. At the time, a ruble and a dollar were about the same. By the early 70s, $34 billion. And a lot of this was either just given away free or on credit. The military specialists, those training them in these countries, reached about 16,000. Civilian personnel, 32,000 by the early 70s. Economic assistance from 1955 to 1974 was about $10 billion. But just in the 4 years from 76 to 80, $44 billion. In addition to all that, the USSR sold their own resources, oil, gas, cotton, whatever, maybe between 30 and 50% below market price, and then purchase the third world's goods at an inflated price, 40, 50% above market value. It's the same thing for the Warsaw Pact countries too. Massive subsidy. $61 billion a subsidy just to the Warsaw Pact countries between 74 and 80. The only thing that the Soviets really got out of it was the permission to build military bases there. Another huge expense. But places like, say, Egypt, Somalia, a few other places, started to worry about dependency on the USSR. And they went out of their way to curtail Soviet presence. And Egypt kicked the Soviets out. But what was a bigger loss to the Soviet bloc than China? Sino-Soviet split in the early 60s was a horrible thing. I hate the fact that you have to give Mao any authority in anything. He shouldn't be treated even as a human being. But China, for some reason, began to claim leadership over the global communist movement, despising what Khrushchev had done. Peaceful coexistence? Khrushchev's mentality was a peaceful transition from capitalism to socialism abroad. Vehemently rejected by Mao. Mao only knew death. He only knew weaponry. He only knew killing and violence and force. Mao himself said, "I don't care," his exact quote, "if a third of humanity perishes, we're going to impose socialism." Mao wasn't kidding. The Great Leap Forward, killing, God knows, 40, 50 million Chinese. Party roundup, police action, artificial famine. The same nonsense. Nazarov suggests that because of the Chinese criticism, the peaceful coexistence, the attack on peaceful coexistence, you did have an already insecure Soviet leadership starting to question itself. The Soviet Union in the 70s did very well abroad, although again, it didn't get much out of it financially. As always, the battle wasn't against Marxism, communism. Very few people in the government knew anything about that. Nixon did. Nixon actually knew it pretty well. Khrushchev was accused of typical Russian aggression and barbarity. He wasn't Russian by ethnicity, he was Ukrainian. And his own, you know, "we will bury you" nonsense, banging the shoe, the UN, the British Prime Minister was speaking in 1960. It embarrassed your more civilized people in Moscow. Now, this is a time to take some care, and I've done this on this show about a trillion times. It's very important here specifically. I came of age at the tail end of the so-called Cold War. I was reading, I was becoming a student specialist in this stuff as the Soviet Union was collapsing, 90, 91, 92. I didn't understand these things as an 18, 19-year-old. I do now. Throughout the Cold War, though, let's say the 50s, 60s, and 70s, what did the regime mean by communism? It isn't like these people were quoting Lenin or Marx at you. No, it was an expanding Russian empire. That was the problem. The ideology wasn't. American investment and trade with the Soviets was never interrupted. It became very fashionable to heap scorn on any anti-communist effort in the U.S. Still, any empire growing as large as the Soviet-Chinese combine would be a problem for Washington. I don't care what ideology it had. But adding the Russian ethnicity, which already had this very negative connotation going back to the Crimean War, made it worse. The system, the ruling class, I'm not talking about the state necessarily, but the ruling class despised anti-communists. Just think of the hate directed against Joe McCarthy. They invented stories about him. The whole story about him doesn't make any sense. He didn't have any power. No one lost their job. No one was attacked here. People like me lose their jobs. Joe McCarthy was a senator from West Virginia. But that's the viciousness of the pro-communist, or at least semi-communist, mentality. The regime, the ruling class was anything but anti-communist. They covered over leftist terrorism throughout the late 60s. Marxist academics, or some variation of Marxism, with government grants, took over the universities. It became a central ideological outlook of them, of the educational system. There were no sanctions domestically on anything communist in the U.S., even Maoist. They'll try to invent things, but it's just not true. You try to support Hitler on campus, see what happens to you. You support Mao, you have friends everywhere. Professors are doing it all the time. That's a sick system just by itself. But the only actual anti-communist entities, you had specific elements within the state. Nixon and Reagan in particular, they were anti-communist consciously. Nixon's writings, Nixon was really probably the last American president who had an independent understanding of foreign policy. He was extremely knowledgeable, which is why he had to go. A lot of it's still Russophobia, I know that. But at least he understood the ideological side of things. Reagan did too. My thesis has always been the Cold War was never against Marxism or Leninism, or even the idea of the USSR. It was against an expanding empire that was said to be run by Russians. That's the problem. 1959, Congress passed the Captive Nations Act, which, by the way, doesn't mention Russia at all amongst the nations enslaved by communism. Now, when I say that there were very few people in Washington who knew anything about Marxism or even Russia, you read the initial draft of the Captive Nations Act, there's places in there, they know so little. They mention a place called Kazakhia. I guess they mean Kazakhstan. They mention Idel Ural. I don't know where that is. They didn't know. They were, the ignorance was such, they I don't know who they thought they were talking about, but even they'll go so far as to say China and Tibet were enslaved by Russian communism. So the ignorance was tremendous. But that visceral contempt for all things Russian was equally tremendous. General Maxwell Taylor, who was the chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff under JFK and LBJ, when he retired, he told the Washington Post in 1982, said that the American conception of the nuclear strike, and I'm quoting him directly here, to the extent possible, targets should be limited to areas with a predominantly ethnic Russian population in order to limit damage in the non-Russian republics, so that what remains will fall into the hands of hostile neighbors, revenge-hungry satellites, and non-Russian elements of the population. Now, this concept, in an academic sense, was put out by Gary Gertner, a 1981 paper called The Strategic Vulnerability of the Multinational State, which I read a billion years ago. Those two entities, the Taylor-Gertner mentality, the Captive Nations Act, the issue wasn't Marxism. There was no analysis of dialectical materialism in any of this. They weren't talking about immiseration or the proletariat and defining it. No, the enemy was a Russian empire. They thought in many ways that communism was a Russian empire disguised. Even your obtuse, most obtuse Ukrainian national special unions say that today. The very fact that China was used as an ally against the USSR, Even in the late 60s, Kissinger was preparing talks here. There were armed clashes on the Sino-Soviet border at this point. But it wasn't until 72 that the Sino-American Agreement was signed. And the Russians saw this, both Russians and Soviet Union, and Soviet Union itself, saw this as an indirect support for the territorial claims of the Chinese communists on parts of Siberia. The fact that Mao was in the process of murdering tens of millions the moment Nixon walked off the plane doesn't seem to be a huge problem for anybody. But that's exactly what was going on. The Jewish chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962, Lyman Lemnitzer, I think he must have been before Maxwell, I'm not sure, that Taylor. Anyway, he issued a report to the Secretary of Defense, which eventually, we know, became Operation Northwoods. Now, none of this was ever accepted. That Fidel Castro, because it was he was a satellite of Russian communism, he needed to go. Not that they supported Batista or anything like that. They did not. But we all know the basic thrust of Operation Northwoods. Lemnitzer, again, a Jew, an Israeli, basically, and I'm quoting him directly here, we could blow up an American ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. The list of victims in American newspapers would create a useful wave of national indignation. We could organize a campaign of terror against communist Cuba, meaning in the USA. We could promote attempts on the lives of Cuban refugees in the United States. Again, all this just to blame the Cubans. We could sink a ship with Cubans on its way to Florida, whether it be real or an imitation. The explosion of plastic bombs at carefully selected points, then arrest a bunch of Cuban agents, releasing incriminating documents. That would be great. These are all scams, of course. He means a terror campaign in America and blaming it on the Cubans. Some version of this was what Operation Northwoods, a much more moderate version of this, was ever put into practice. But I think in 1962, he overestimated the indignation that the media was capable of. Just a few years later, killing of American sailors by leftist terrorists was largely covered up. In 1985, Aero Air Flight 1285 led to the deaths of at least 250 American Army personnel. And to this day, very few people have heard of it. This general underestimated just how leftist the media had become, and thus how selective their indignation. The ruling class backed Castro, but the state did not. Now, JFK rejected all of this, and I don't even want to say that Lemnitzer's mentality was the dominant one. If you ever looked at the sanctions law, I dealt with this before, the sanctions law against Castro, there's more holes in it. There's very few things that really are affected by it. And it's always changing. I have a whole paper on what sanctions really are, legally and practically. You know, people really don't know what they're talking about when they mention a sanction. Beyond that, though, you also started seeing from the U.S. and the Israelis a huge increase in the number of assassination of foreign government officials. You know that list. All of a sudden, it's all over the place. Starting in the late 50s, roughly. I mean, even in the last 10 years, Mossad has murdered hundreds of Iranian scientists and Lebanese political leaders over the decade of total impunity. Iranian scientists who had no connection with weaponry. This is considered perfectly acceptable. Not only that, it earns money from the U.S. I'm not to say, of course, the KGB was involved in this. They usually aimed at a lower level, and they never had the scale. Now, they never had the Israeli connection to ramp everything up. Of course, the camps continued to function in the USSR, but abroad, they behave much more cautiously. They're very image conscious. The American authorities did not. Solzhenitsyn wrote a paper where some of this came up. It's one of my favorites. I read it again, one of these things I read a million years ago. Misconceptions on Russia are a threat to America. 1980, it came out in Foreign Affairs, I think, at first. So much of what I've been saying is inspired from this paper, but he's a lot more diplomatic than me. The first thing he says is that the West doesn't understand Marxism at all. The West really struggles with the nature of ideology in general, let alone the spiritual side of this. Not to mention, focusing on Russia as the problem rather than Marxism or the Soviet Union is a whole separate question. And in that paper, he says the Soviet Union can't function without the use of terror. There's no other reason to do anything there. There's no religious commonality. There's no ethnic commonality. There's not a profit motive. Without private ownership, there is no, you know, there's nothing, there's no incentive other than a pistol. Yes, the American state apparatus, as I just showed you, then and now, was mostly clueless about Russian history and Russian society. But that part of it, they were quite aware. The elite in the U.S. was never anti-communist as such. They weren't even opposed to the USSR. Yeah, that empire, getting that large, covering that much territory, yes, it was just going to worry anybody, especially with the Chinese. But that to one side, the ideology wasn't understood, let alone attacked. The fact that it was perceived as being Russian, you know, when you have the Captive Nations Act, now official law, I mean, not anymore, obviously, but official law saying that Tibet is controlled by Russian communists, China is controlled by Russian communists, you realize that there's something wrong there. The ignorance is pretty tremendous. Let me quote Solzhenitsyn here. There's going to be a lot of familiar themes, those who have listened to me for a long time. Solzhenitsyn says in the 1980 paper, he says there's a hostile and distorted portrayal of old Russia, something that's come to be taken for granted among American academics. Let me quote him there in more detail. While communism was still the object of Western infatuation, it was hailed as the indisputable dawning of a new era. But ever since communism has had to be condemned, it has been ingeniously ascribed to the age-old Russian slave mentality. This interpretation currently enjoys wide support, since it's so advantageous to many people. If the crimes and vices of communism are not inherent to it, but can be attributed entirely to the traditions of old Russia, then it follows that there exists no fundamental threat to the Western world. Well, even more than that, if it's the defective Russian character that's the problem, then there's nothing wrong with Marxism, or even Leninism, since he wasn't Russian. Very few things in the world irritate me than when some kid said the Marxist ideology has never been tried, because their personal version of it, because it didn't work out, and their utopia hasn't come true, therefore it can't be true. You know what you say to these people? You say, well, if that wasn't true socialism, then the U.S. isn't true capitalism. You know, you two can play at that game. It's so stupid. Then again, you know, there's such ignorance on this suffering of Poles, Ukrainians, Hungarians, whatever, Romanians, and Russians especially. Yeah, it's to be blamed on the ideas of Marx and Lenin. Russian imperialism had nothing to do with it, since the earlier generations of the Soviet state were not Russian. And only one dictator of the Soviet Union was Russian. That was Gorbachev. Andropov was a Jew. Brezhnev was Ukrainian. Khrushchev was Ukrainian. Stalin was Georgian. Chernenko, of course, that name is Ukrainian. And Lenin, of course, was nothing. Jewish, German, whatever the hell he was. So in the 1970s, I've mentioned Soviet 1970s as a time when the Jews separated from the Soviet Union, and hence the profit motive, that the profits that anyone could gain from controlling the Soviet Union went away. The building boom after the war was now creaking and very old. The U.S. was shooting ahead, and the Soviets were still worrying about steel and coal. Now, there were a few things the Soviets were doing very well. The number of conventional and nuclear weapons the Soviets had shot ahead of the U.S. and was increasing. The West in the 70s, and this is something that Reagan quite legitimately campaigned on, there was very little resistance. Huge chunks of the Third World fell all over Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America. Latin America, Eastern Africa, Ethiopia, Angola. You go through the whole list of people, one country after another. If it wasn't for General Suharto, all of Asia would have fallen, because Indonesia was the fourth largest by population country in the world. If that fell, then the Philippines would have fallen. Thank God for him. But you had people in NATO itself seeing not the Soviet concept, but the Russian concept as the problem. I think in the Third World, it was 20 states in just a few years that fell to the Soviet Union in various guises. But at the same time, they adopted the course of détente. And this is one of the reasons that Solzhenitsyn was very upset. He was expelled from the Soviet Union in 1974. It's one of the reasons that then a few years later, he wrote the other article, "You guys don't get it. Not only do you guys not get the Soviet Union, you don't get yourselves." The press then and now, when they talk about when the Soviet Union was in existence, when they talked about something positive like the ballet or certain artistic phrases, they'll use the Soviet ballet, the Soviet, you know, various Soviet symphonies. But when it came to tanks in Budapest, it was Russian. That was quite deliberate. In many ways, it's still being done by historians today. I have in my possession the FBI file for Solzhenitsyn in a PDF form. All of the white emigres were tracked by the FBI. Something tells me that these make-believe Holocaust survivors don't have FBI files. They were always distrusted. But the strategy of détente, some peaceful coexistence, promoted by Khrushchev and supported by the left in the U.S., Khrushchev, at least in public but not in private, believed in the peaceful victory of socialism. Détente for the West was a belief in the peaceful victory of liberal democracy and capitalism. Now, the Jewish issue in the USSR was about to explode. I don't think we're going to get to it today. We have to get to it next week. But there was a time, because of the Israeli immigration issue, it became fashionable to be not anti-communist but anti-Soviet. It's easy. I mean, the Soviets made it easy. A false and very crude view of history and ideology. A total lack of personal or even collective freedom. It's an easy target. People desire truth and various forms of freedom, at least you know, your higher functioning people. But the convergence theory, this is what guided the leaders of UNESCO, created by in 1954, and then the Helsinki process, and the subsequent Western influence on perestroika. To the Western point of view, was that it's more advantageous to just let the Soviet regime run out of steam on its own. The poor members of the socialist camp were a huge burden, as I mentioned, on the Soviet Union. Just the credit, which I didn't mention yet, the credit extended to these already broke nations amounted to almost 100 billion rubles. I think it was 86 billion. 86 billion rubles was roughly $86 billion at the time in credit. Now, that when I use the word regime with a capital R, this was only taking shape. The regime in its true form only really took its full form after 1991. But elements of the ruling class certainly existed. They didn't need most of these states anyway in the Third World. The rest, they held by their own credit system or debt. And then playing on Soviet worry for the Chinese card, showing even a more brutal form of Marxism, and which Solzhenitsyn shamed America for this, is something that, you know, the human rights issue, I don't usually use that kind of language. But at the time, and given the nature of the Soviet Union, it was legitimate. But the ruling classes in the West were only using it as a weapon of war. 1962, there were many of these labor rebellions. This time in 1962 in Novochercask, and a whole bunch of workers were shot by the internal police. Well, the same thing happened in Paris, February 8, 1962. A whole bunch of people were shot there, too. In 1954, the Soviets tested an atomic bomb on its own population at the Totsk site in the Urals. Several hundred servicemen, all kinds of equipment, and villages were liquidated in the process. So you had irradiation of the population in the U.S. too, not quite the scale of the Soviet Union. As far as atomic tests, they decided to test on the Japanese instead. Neither side, no matter how you spin the Cold War, especially at this point, 70s, 80s, 90s, or 70s and 80s, I should say, neither side were really fighting for truth with a capital T. They both had, as I've said 1,000 times, their own version of their materialist Darwinian paradise. Partial truths were important. The lack of freedom in the USSR was a legitimate issue. I don't care who talks about it. Détente and the convergence theory, this unification, future unification of capitalist democracies within the Marxist USSR in some kind of single community, that was kind of a Western response to the peaceful coexistence doctrine of Khrushchev. But the ideological struggle, this was ideological convergence too, not just political. But this was kind of what they meant by a peaceful victory over the Soviet camp. The problem is what it sought to put in its place. It was not only just as awful, but Russia in the 1990s was at least as bad as the Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s. Probably far worse. You had starvation. Unemployment at 70%. Now, for the first time in American-Soviet relations, you had sanctions placed on the USSR. And what was that for? At the forefront of détente, by the way, it took the form of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, 1974, adopted by Congress. It erected trade barriers for the first time, contingent on Jews being allowed to emigrate to Israel. That's what caused sanctions. Not the mass slaughters, not the closing of thousands of churches. No, a handful of Jews wanting to leave the Soviet Union for Israel. The Soviets didn't permit it because so much of their bureaucracy would fall apart. There were too many of them. This finally, savage Russians, this finally is when some trade barriers, and it was very limited, would be erected. So in the 20 years, like between 48 when Israel was founded in 1967, fewer than 7,000 Jews from the Soviet Union, at least officially, emigrated from the USSR to Israel. 1972, it was 30,000. 79, 51,000. Now, if this was the first time you're going to have sanctions, the world knew, especially in the Third World, knew that the Jews ruled foreign policy in the U.S. Then the Soviets said in 72, when this amendment was passed in the U.S., well, we want a fee that covers our investment in your education. You pay that fee and you can leave. It was roughly between 3,000 and 9,000 rubles, depending on their qualifications. Western countries did that kind of thing all the time. Again, storm of indignation erupted in the USA. That's when the amendment actually appeared. It was over that issue, and the Soviets gave in. So now the Soviets had to worry. Wait a minute, we're going to train Jews in sophisticated, top-secret defense technology, only to see them go to Israel and supply specialists to the enemy? But there was no why. It was just more claims of Soviet anti-Semitism were heard. All of a sudden, it was okay to be anti-Soviet. Not anti-communist, but anti-Soviet. This was the period of time, I want to say 1974, started the substantial separation of the Jewish mind from the Soviet Union. Then, of course, the victorious Israelis, 1967 and 1973, Soviet Jewry and the Soviet leadership found themselves now on opposite sides of this. That's a very specific reason why there is now a separation between Jews in general and the Soviet state. It was a Jewish world that they were a part of, not the Soviet one. It's not a really big complicated issue. Jacques Attali, on his book on the Warburg banking dynasty, that Jews seem to be very adept at leaving countries that are doomed to decline and moving to emerging new centers of economic strength. So in the Middle Ages, they exchanged the Mediterranean for Northern Europe, eventually, you know, Britain, and then eventually the USA. And it's similar, the Jewish flight from the sinking ship of the communist regime in the 70s. The doom at the time, which was not certain, but it was increasingly discussed in high-level circles, especially among economists, just not in America. There's also the Helsinki Act, the final act of the Conference of Security and Cooperation in Europe, Helsinki, 1975. It has nothing to do with the Jews, of course, not specifically. But it was the human rights concept. This was cited by a lot of intellectuals in the camps. It recognized the borders of all European states that had formed after World War II as final. But it also proclaimed a mandatory observance of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is a more extreme version of the Jacobin. That document became a powerful weapon, because the Soviets signed it. It was a powerful weapon against the USSR. Of course, this was just a tactical move. The détente was a tactical move. My God, where was the Soviets, you know, expanding? Mongolia, Cuba, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Iraq, Libya, Algeria, South Yemen, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, Nicaragua, Zimbabwe, come on. Everywhere. The West, on the other hand, didn't want a military confrontation. But more importantly, to change the mentality, very typical here, the psychology, to change the psychology among Soviet elites. That required support for things like, you know, national separatism and the encouragement of an envy, the Western standard of living. And it was a powerful weapon because it was something that, you know, was based on some truth. It required the Soviets to engage in a lot of mental gymnastics. Their special pleading, trying to explain this away, made them look terrible. The command economy was exhausted. You couldn't reform it unless you replaced it with something very substantial. And this was the era where the party spent hundreds of billions on these huge, massive, gargantuan construction projects of the century. Crazy things, you know, trying to reverse the course of rivers. They did so much damage here, these massive, gargantuan, monumental forms of building. You look up anywhere the abandoned projects of the old Soviet Union, you'll see some of these. A ridiculous amount of money was spent. Soviet debt increased in 1971, was about $1 billion or ₹1 billion. 10 years later, in 81, almost $30 billion. The waste was awful. Not to mention a huge increase in defense spending, plus everything we talked about in their investment in the Third World. But in Brezhnev's final years, the U.S. started to change its tactics. They're looking at the very elderly Politburo, ideological inertia, severe internal socioeconomic problems. What could the Soviet Union really do? And the center of that policy was Afghanistan, forcing the Soviets into a terrible situation. Either you lose everything that you've invested in a very strategically important country, or protect its investment by using military force. Reagan was elected not too long after this, the evil empire speech. He was true. He was right to say that. CIA Director Casey, who worked for the international banks, Defense Secretary Weinberger, quite legitimately, and this is, you know, you always have bittersweet concepts here, uniting external and internal opponents of the USSR. The Soviet Union at any time had to go. It was an evil empire. What was it replaced with? Well, that was the problem. So we're going to end part one here on the fall of the Soviet Union. And next week, hopefully, we'll finish up and we'll talk about American strategy as we get into the 1990s. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.